My name's Ben Barrow, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording record by record. Welcome to a brand new season, and thank you for coming back. Hello. It's fair to say, quite a bit has changed if you're a fan of Bob Dylan since we last spoke. We have a brand new album, and it's important to point out that it's a classic brand new album as well, as we'll discover in this episode. Just before we do, can I say thank you to everyone that has donated to the podcast recently. We've had loads of donations in the little pre-season break, if we can call it that. If you have bought me a coffee, then thank you so much. I will get around to replying to every single person that has. I think we're almost there at the moment, but thank you. And if you want to donate to the podcast, of course you can do that. The link to my Buy Me a Coffee page is in the episode's description, as per usual. Let's crack on, shall we? Let's have a look at 2020's Rough and Rowdy Ways.
I live on the streets named after a saint. Women in the churches wear powder and paint.
In the middle of a global pandemic the world hadn't seen the likes of for over 100 years, Bob Dylan, at 4 in the morning UK time, on the 27th of March 2020, tweeted the following. Greetings to my fans and followers with gratitude for all your support and loyalty across the years. This is an unreleased song we recorded a while back that you might find interesting. Stay safe, stay observant, and may God be with you. Bob Dylan. It was accompanied with a link to Murder Most Foul, his first original single for 8 years. The world, which had been bleak and unrelenting for weeks and weeks and weeks, suddenly looked a little brighter.
It was a dark day in Dallas, November 63. A day that would live on in infamy.
Not that he planned any of it, but it was pretty much the perfect moment to release a 17-minute reflective song mentioning a life-changing global event. It was a song that matched the world's mood. Also, its prolonged runtime could be enjoyed in full during lockdown. In other days, a 17-minute song might be lost to that meeting or having to take your headphones off for your takeaway coffee order. But during lockdown, it was a song to be savoured, a song to be pored over more than usual. And not for the first time in Dylan's career, he was the cultural conversation for much of that week. Returning in this environment with such a bold choice of song could have unravelled very quickly, but pleasingly, Murder Most Foul is arguably one of the best things we've had from Dylan in decades, if not a shining light in his entire career. It starts by musing over the famous Kennedy assassination, something that for Dylan's generation was, and rightfully so, an event that changed their lives. Here he uses that as a jumping off point to then explore the decline of America, before surrounding himself with some of his favourite things to offer a comforted ending to the song after some pretty ominous and end-of-days undertones. It starts with the facts. Dylan sings, "'Twas a dark day in Dallas in November 63, a day that will live on in infamy. President Kennedy was a riding high, a good day to be living, and a good day to die." It's an opening line that is delivered with such charisma, it almost makes you dizzy. From here, the rest of the verse details the shooting. Although it's not really an account, it's an imagining. Dylan sets the scene with a poetic license, bringing in other potential Kennedy assassinations that were uncovered before this fatal one. Plots to kill Kennedy were apparently stopped in Tampa and Chicago, and we hear this in the line of, "was a matter of timing and the timing was right." He then refers to a potential conspiracy theory, not for the last time in the song, with the lyrics, "you've got unpaid debts we've come to collect." The "we" there is obviously refuting the lone gunman theory and is possibly alluding to Kennedy's supposed collusion with the mafia, which turned sour. Later, the conspiracy theories keep coming as we hear, "the day they blew out the brains of the king, thousands were watching, no one saw a thing." This is wrapped up in a Shakespearean aura with that king line, backed up by the fact that "Murder Most Foul" is actually uttered by the king as a line in Hamlet. Elsewhere in the verse, Dylan alludes to the magic bullet theory, another conspiracy theory, which we shall re-examine later. Next, and at the end of the verse, we move to the song's other lyrical tempo, as Dylan asks the legendary disc jockey Wolfman Jack to howl for the dead president. For anyone unfamiliar with Wolfman Jack's work, he used to howl at the start of most of his broadcasts. I should know, I'm a big fan. And also, around about 10 years ago, I worked for a radio station that carried Wolfman Jack's legendary shows. I had to edit them, and let me tell you, there was a lot of howling. That's a side issue. He also here is the gatekeeper for the song's other dimension. Two narratives seem to run in tandem from this point on. Whilst we do get words from that fatal day in Dallas, we also cross-dissolve into cultural references from the 60s and beyond. For example, Dylan sings, "Hush, little children, you'll understand. The Beatles are coming, they're going to hold your hand." Which is an obvious reference to a Beatles song, while the "Hush, little children" line also connects us back with the previous line of "Rub-a-dub-dub." Fellow Liverpudlians Jerry and the Pacemakers also get a shout out after the Beatles in the form of a ferry across the Mersey reference. Before, we're back with JFK and the line, "There's three bums coming all dressed in rags," which refers to the famous photo of the three tramps of Dealey Plaza. Three men were pictured in Dallas that day, and they were pictured being escorted away by police. Conspiracy theorists have raised some questions about these men and their possible connection with the plot due to some inconsistencies in their appearance. We continue along this train of thought as the Grassy Knoll is mentioned, the famous site of the supposed second gunman. But in its slipstream, we also get a load of 60s references, the most prominent being in the line, "I'm going to Woodstock, it's the Aquarian Age. Then I'll go to Altamont and sit near the stage." While Woodstock is as synonymous with 60s music as gin is with tonic, the lesser-known Altamont Free Concert happened in December 1969, right at the end of the decade of free love. This juxtaposition is interesting. While Woodstock puts us in the mind of a happy, peaceful event, Altamont was not. It was intended to be the West Coast version of Woodstock, but instead, it featured a murder. Four would die at the hands of the Hell's Angels, and scores of people were also injured. Rolling Stone, in fact, called it rock and roll's all-time worst day. This sets out the stall for the rest of the song as we watch America descend into the doldrums, the feeling being that with JFK, the hope of a whole country dies, and it never quite recovers. At the start of the fourth verse, Dylan sings, "What's new, pussycat? What did I say? I said the soul of a nation's been torn away, and it's beginning to go into a slow decay." Elsewhere, Dylan even says goodbye to Uncle Sam at one point, and we also hear the line, "The age of the Antichrist has only just begun." In the song, there's also some jokes thrown into the mix too. "Living in a nightmare on Elm Street," Bob sings at one point, clearly referencing the horror film Nightmare on Elm Street, but it's also a glib nod to the fact that Elm Street is the name of the street where the assassination took place. "You got me dizzy, Miss Lizzie, you filled me with lead," he sings on the third verse, which is another Beatles reference, or possibly a nod to Larry Williams, who actually wrote the song, but we assume the Beatles. However, the jokes don't continue. This verse is where the song turns a little. It's the last verse where the Dallas lines and the cultural references run side by side. After this, the song's lyrics take on another form. For me, the key is when Dylan sings, "Cross the Trinity River, let's keep hope alive. Turn the radio on, don't touch the dials. Parkland Hospital, only 6 more miles. At this point of the song, we appear to be in Kennedy's ambulance, speeding to Parkland, which is, of course, where they took him. In the early lyrics of this verse, he is apparently still alive. There's hope mentioned. While it's never kept a secret what happens to our protagonist, murder and death are ever present in this song. For the most part, it's in the future tense. The line, for example, "We're gonna kill you," or the lyric, "Put your foot in the tank and then step on the gas, try and make it to the underpass," which doesn't quite rhyme with my accent. But inevitably, by the end of the verse, it's all over. We hear lines of, "That magic bullet of yours has gone to my head. I'm just like Patsy Cline. Never shot anyone from in front or behind. I've got blood in my eye, got blood in my ear. I'm never going to make it to a new frontier." They're kind of spellbinding when you see them written down. And that final line is a reference to Kennedy's speech after winning the 1960 election, where he stated, "We stand today on the edge of a new frontier, the frontier of the 1960s, the frontier of unknown opportunities and perils, the frontier of unfilled hopes and unfilled threats." JFK, it would appear, is now dead. Johnson is sworn in as president in the final lines of verse 3, and with this, we fall into a dreamlike wondering. It plays out like a film, going from one scene of chaos in the bloodied Cadillac and the speeding ambulance to a feeling of comfort. We hear a string of song requests. It feels like JFK is in the afterlife, cruising along in his car, unharmed, listening to the radio still playing, asking for some songs. Dylan sings, "Wolfman Jack, he's speaking in tongues. He's going on and on at the top of his lungs. Play me a song, Mr. Wolfman Jack. Play it for me in my long Cadillac." I suspect there's quite a bit of Dylan in here too. We know this event had affected him. He wrote a poem about it almost straight after, and there's been speculation it's made its way into many of his lyrics in different places. But not just that. With those lines we saw before, how Dylan is hinting the hope of his home nation died when the bullet hit Kennedy, here in this second section of the song, we could be hearing from an older Dylan, a man who has seen hope rise and then disappear. And here he is surrounding himself with the things he loves. He's looking back at the hope of a nation that he himself was heavily involved with. In fact, Dylan and JFK were poster boys for 1960s America and all that comes with it. But in 2020, with everyone trying to make America great again, that future hasn't quite happened. While this song predates the death of George Floyd, it's the same situation. Dylan was singing about civil rights in his 20s, and now in his almost 80s, atrocities are still happening due to the colour of one's skin. By the final two verses, we hear he's lost all hope. He's given up, and he's comforting himself with his favourite songs and the singers he's loved. He walks with the ghost of JFK through 20th century pop culture as we hear references to Queen and The Who, songs from Billy Joel and the Eagles, Marilyn Monroe, Chicago the musical, or perhaps even the 70s film All That Jazz. There's yet more nods to the Fab Four and Memphis in June, the second time this has been referenced on a Dylan song. This then leads us to him throwing his own and latest offering in right at the very end.
They love me or leave me by the great bird power. Play the bloodstained banner, play murder most foul.
Despite a ton of lost hope and quite a bit of nostalgia and sadness, there is also some resistance right at the end of this song. Bob sings, play the bloodstained banner. The bloodstained banner is the flag of the Confederate States, but it's also a song. It was first published in 1880, and it's also been called We Are Soldiers, Soldiers of the Lord, or Soldiers of the Cross. Its main lyrics are, we are soldiers in the army. We have to fight, although we have to cry. We've got to hold up the bloodstained banner. We've got to hold it up till we die. Despite all hope being lost, there is still life in Dylan yet. Perhaps he's even saying, with the voice of JFK gone, let us be guided by the voice and music of his requests. And by adding his own song in at the very end, there's a feeling of it not quite being over just yet. We've got to hold up the flag until we die. Musically, there's not many fireworks, but the detail is interesting and the mood is exceptional. These lyrics, the song's theme, and the historical gravitas of the event deserve some equally magnetic sonics, and that, thankfully, is exactly what we get. The tune is awash with reflective tones. It's a soundscape that captures that murky, eerie crossover between life and death that we hear in the song's narrative. It's mournful and it's also fragile. There's also a grandeur and a gravitas to it at the same time, and crucially, it's utterly unique. The worst thing for this song would be to bathe these lines about Kennedy and everything else in a sentimental warm synth with a four-on-the-floor drum beat and big ballad drums cascading down over showboating guitars and overly sentimental strings. Instead, the only way I can describe the sonics are that it sounds like an orchestra is packing up round Dylan as he sings alone on the stage. It's a slow, loose descend, and by the final lines, it sounds like Dylan is delivering them with the house lights going up around him. The violin parts played by Donny Herron are beautiful, as is what sounds like a cello or possibly a harmonium. But what really creates the wonderful atmosphere for me is the percussion. It's funny because there's hardly any percussion at all, really, but I love the allusion to a drum line. In keeping with my earlier point, it sounds like a drum sound check almost, like Matt Chamberlain is just mic testing his skins. It's a curious yet wonderful delivery. It's not out of time, but it's not right on the nose either. Every now and then he tickles a big cymbal, giving the piece just the right amount of sentimentality. It sounds great 4 minutes in when it's paired with a metallic screeching sound, which might be a synth or a guitar effect, we're not quite sure. This little moment really helps set the tone of the song's atmosphere. It's hardly a big statement of intent, but like a movie sound design, this does such a great job in creating the right mood for the lyrics.
See if you can shoot the invisible man. Goodbye, Charlie. Goodbye, Uncle Sam. Frankly, Miss Scarlet, I don't give a damn.
The drums in the song expand and contract at various points. The cymbals occasionally buzz like a fly caught in a glass. Other times we hear the toms beaten like a tribal drum that's been run through an underwater sound effect.
The mystery train for Mr. Mystery. The man who fell down dead like a rootless tree. Lay it for the Reverend,
play it for the pastor, play it for the dog that got no master.
The thing that tops this atmosphere, though, is the piano. Once again, it's not really played, it's just sort of there. Due to a classic Dylan decision to be awkward, there's not really a lot of specifics in the album liner notes as to who played what. We don't even get a producer listed, something we'll look back into later. We don't really know who played this drum line, but what we do know is Fiona Apple is listed as an additional musician, and many have come to the conclusion that it's her on the piano. Although Alan Pasquale mentioned on Twitter about spending an evening in the studio working on the song, and this piano isn't a million miles away from his work on Dylan's Nobel Prize lecture, so we can assume it might be one of them or a combination of both of them. Regardless, it's a wonderful sound. It's ambient in tone, and it once again sounds like a musician packing down or even warming up. It's like someone just playing around with the keys, killing time caught in a moment. All of this adds up to a truly wonderful sound. Dylan has never quite sounded like this. It's close to the Lanois sound that we've discussed so many times on this podcast, but it feels a little different, a little more modern than that. It's, once again, breathtakingly unique. It's impressively subtle for a 17-minute song, and it shows incredible restraint as it never leaps into a big showstopper. It's like its subject matter has no happy ending, and I think that's important. There's no sentimental, unrealistic, big, warm, cozy payoff. Not a wonderful lifting string line that makes you feel better. Not a huge conclusion with big drums. It is what it is. It's Murder Most Foul. This is one of my favourite sections in the whole song.
Don't ask what your country can do for you. Cash on the bellhead, money to burn. Dealey Plaza, make a left-hand turn. I'm going down to the crossroads, gonna flag a ride. The place where faith, hope, and charity die.
After Murder Most Foul's release, we only had to wait 3 weeks before we had another new tune, and also confirmation that this was a new era and not just a one-off song. The second single from Rough and Rowdy Ways is its opener, I Contain Multitudes. This is Dylan at his most frank. The lines say what you feel he's been trying to articulate ever since the first person called him the new Messiah. I'm a man of contradictions, I'm a man of many moods, I contain multitudes, he sings. After decades of analysis, and I can only say sorry for adding to that, Bob, and being in the public eye, he's making the point he's made many times before. He's not one thing or the other. He's like all of us, like everything. He's more complex than that. While he was a member of the 60s and that counterculture scene, he's also a man that does advertisements for huge conglomerates. Dylan has always loved to shun labels and descriptions, and here he is doing it once again. It's one of my favourite things about Dylan. It's the reason why he found God. It's the reason why he did self-portrait. It's the reason he is who he is. He's a person, not a one-dimensional thing. In a rare New York Times interview, Dylan said of the song, "Obviously the catalyst for the song is the title line. It's one of those where you write it on instinct, kind of like a trance state. Most of my recent songs are like that. The lyrics are the real thing, tangible. They're not metaphors." And those lyrics, as we've come to expect from Dylan, contain a multitude, pun intended, of references. From William Blake with a line about songs of experience, to David Bowie, to Mott the Hoople, to Edgar Allan Poe, and many, many more. The biggest reference of all, though, is to the American poet Walt Whitman's work, Song for Myself, which is where the song gets its title. The line is, "Do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. I am large, I contain multitudes." The poem celebrates the theme of democracy and the oneness of mankind, specifically the American people. And so here Dylan updates it with a look at our current world. In this tribal world of the year 2020, with right and left wing, with millennial and boomers, facts and alternative facts, black and white, conservative and Labour, Republican and Democrat, the song is saying that life isn't actually like that. It's not what you see on Twitter or on Fox News. It's not all right and all wrong. It's grey, there's middle grounds, there's both sides to an argument to be considered. Dylan is not just one thing, and neither is our society. It's a song that focuses on big and small multitudes, about relationships, with the wonderful line, "I'll drink to the truth and the things we said. I'll drink to the man that shares your bed." To other areas like art, with a lyric about painting nudes and landscapes. He also references a trio of interesting figures during one of the song's mini bridges as he sings, "I'm just like Anne Frank, like Indiana Jones," and then British bad boys, the Rolling Stones. In the New York Times article, Bob addressed this lyric. He says, "Her story means a lot to me. It's profound and hard to articulate, especially in modern culture. Everyone's got such a short attention span. But you're taking Anne's name out of context. She's part of a trilogy. You could just as well ask, what made you decide to include Indiana Jones or the Rolling Stones? The names themselves are not solitary. It's a combination of them that adds up to something more than their singular parts. To go too much into detail is irrelevant. This song is like a painting. You can't see it all at once if you're standing too close. The individual pieces are just part of a whole." And later he says, "John Williams, that score brought that character of Indiana Jones to life. Without that music, it wouldn't have been much of a movie. It's the music that makes Indy come alive. So that maybe was one of the reasons he is in the song. I don't know. All three names just came to me at once." Dylan also gives us an insight to the song's writing process. "I contain multitudes is more like trance writing," he says. "Well, actually, it's not more like trance writing. It is trance writing. It's the way I actually feel about things. It's my identity, and I'm not going to question it. I'm in no position to." While he's quite open about that song's writing process, the LP's formation is shrouded in a little more mystery. In fact, we don't really know much at all. It's been half confirmed this was recorded in January and February 2020 at Sound City Studios in LA with a lineup of Bob Dylan on vocals, guitar and harmonica, Charlie Sexton on guitar, Bob Britt on guitar, Donny Herron on steel guitar, violin, accordion and mandolin, Tony Garnier on bass guitar and acoustic bass, and Matt Chamberlain on drums. We then have additional musicians, Blake Mills, Ben Montench, Alan Pasquala, Fiona Apple and Tommy Rhodes. Blake Mills, though, seems to be the interesting component here. As we've heard, there was no official producer on the record. Dylan self-produced under the pseudonym Jack Frost ever since 1997's Time Out of Mind, but nothing is listed for this record, which has led some to speculate. Mills runs Sound City and has produced for Fiona Apple in the past, as well as Alabama Shakes and John Legend, to name but a few. He's also a singer-songwriter, and a pretty good one at that. His records are definitely worth your time when you get a spare moment. Shortly after the release of the LP, he posted a series of videos on Instagram of him playing the guitar parts for a number of songs from Rough and Rowdy Ways. Ben Montench commented on the post saying, "Additional." Just that one word, additional. Mills replied with a shrug emoji. With this, we can assume that Mills had more of a role on the album than just an additional musician, whatever that actually means. Especially given that his guitar playing in those Instagram videos was spot on in terms of the actual sound. It's quite hard to recreate the exact sound of a guitar if you weren't involved in its creative process at some point. So perhaps Mills was more of a producer on the record and there was a disagreement about his level of involvement come the end of the sessions. Or perhaps his role grew as recording went on and Dylan wanted to keep his long-term players happy by not elevating this new boy to such a prestigious role. Or, as I suspect, it was more of a group effort and rather than label four or five producers, they just left it. Either way, the production is both the album's strong point and its only weakness for me. As I mentioned, I love the Sonics of Murder Most Foul. It's one of Dylan's best sounding songs for a long, long time. And there's also astoundingly good production on the track My Own Version of You, which is another record highlight.
All through the summers into January, I've been visiting morgues and monasteries, looking for the necessary body parts. Limbs and livers and brains and hearts.
The atmosphere of this song is like a Victorian graveyard. It creeps and haunts. The lyrics are wonderful in concept and execution. It's also once again very unique. Dylan turns Dr. Frankenstein and tries to recreate a person by stealing body parts from morgues and monasteries, as he says. We then move through a ton of cultural references, which you pretty much expect from Dylan at this point. He doesn't seem to be recreating a lover, though. At times, you can read this as a love song, but for me, it's something slightly different. It feels like our narrator is looking to form a human who he's lost, perhaps a human with values from a different moral time. Our narrator, who sounds aged and weary, is looking round desperate to see a happy world full of good people before he leaves it. "I'll be saved by the creature that I create," he sings at one point. And elsewhere, "I'll be in the Black Horse Tavern on Armageddon Street." While in the fourth verse we hear, "I want to do things for the benefit of all mankind." The final verse has us in line with Mary Shelley's classic novel as Dylan sings, "One strike of lightning is all that I need, and a blast of electricity that runs at top speed. Shimmy your ribs, I'll stick in the knife, gonna jumpstart my creation to life. I wanna bring someone to life, turn back the years, do it with laughter and do it with tears." The line about electricity is an obvious reference to the famous It's Alive scene from the book's film, and a nice moment of imagery too. The sonics of the song match that tale of gothic horror. There's a fog of pedal steel dancing in the shadows around the other instruments, giving us a creeping kind of ghostly sound. The lead guitar's single strum, which again sounds very Blake Mills-like, see his latest album for some similar sounds, is ever so slightly akin to the sound effects of a horror film. It in the smallest way nods to that classic string screech of a slasher, except here it's obviously much, much more subtle, but kind of fulfills the same job.
After midnight, if you still want to meet, I'll be at the Black Horse Tavern on Armageddon Street. Two doors down, not that far to walk, I'll hear your footsteps, you won't have to knock.
In fact, that's the brilliance of the track's sound. It nods to the lyric's macabre descriptions without hamming it up too much. It doesn't turn into a corny, cheap pastiche, ruining the tension. I particularly like the creeping bass line. It's not a million miles away from something you'd hear on, say, Scooby-Doo, but it's pulled off with such skill and showmanship, it never crosses the line. It's a very clean-cut sound as well. Unlike a lot of Dylan records, this doesn't sound overwhelmingly live. Dylan has always pretty much cut his records live there in the room, and while I think this album was cut live like usual, it's been recorded in a way to make it sound less live than normal. It just sounds less like they're all in a room together than an album like Modern Times, for example. Possibly again due to Blake Mills' involvement. I also love that mandolin on this song too. It comes from Donny Herrin, it becomes a feature of the album, and for me recalls the dobro guitar from Oh Mercy. Like I mentioned before, the production of this album, especially this song and Murder Most Foul, at times sounds like a Daniel Lanois record. Lanois was the producer of Oh Mercy and Time Out of Mind. Regular podcast listeners will know I'm a huge fan of his work. And while at times this does sound like a Lanois production, it also strays into imitation Lanois. Don't get me wrong, I enjoy the production immensely, but for the most part, the songs lack the depth and innovation of a track like Man in the Long Black Coat, for example, or Lovesick. Even away from a Lanois-type sound, they lack a point of difference that you get with a tune like Ballad of Thin Man or One More Cup of Coffee. Apart from a couple of little tricks here and there, they sound exactly like you'd expect them to sound. Which is no bad thing, but this brilliant album could be made even better with a sonic surprise here and there, something different, something strange and attention-grabbing. Whilst we do get that, for me, we don't get it enough. Without hearing a note, you could safely predict how this album might sound with a couple of variations. There's one or two blues songs, there's an acoustic number here and there, there's lots of pedal steel guitar, etc, etc, etc. Whilst Dylan explores some new ideas that we haven't really heard from him before, they're never thrilling in the way that he has thrilled us with other sonics before. Of course, there are some nice little moments away from the ones I've mentioned. I like, for example, some of the really polished guitar riffs. Of course, Dylan has used riffs many, many times before. He's always using them. But on songs like Key West and I've Made Up My Mind to Give Myself to You, they're polished riffs. Polished riffs you'd expect from a slick rock band. It's just a little more commercial sounding than we're used to with Dylan. This is something that is not usually Dylan's style, really, outside of the 80s. We're used to getting looser riffs, like the ones found on Spirit on the Water, for example, from the album Modern Times, or Mississippi from Love and Theft. We also have some backing vocals on the aforementioned I've Made Up My Mind to Give Myself to You. But they're unlike the boombastic delivery from the Christian Records or Street Legal. Here, they're fragile, and just like we saw with the riffs, they're a little bit more commercial sounding.
I'm sitting on my terrace, lost in the stars.
Charlie Sexton delivers these backing vocals and does a really good job. The song itself is a classic Dylan love ballad. Like we've seen before from Dylan the Love Poet, it's beautifully simple and simplicity is its beauty. He opens with, "I'm sitting on my terrace, lost in the stars, listening to the sounds of the sad guitars. Been thinking it all over and I've thought it all through. I've made up my mind to give myself to you." Dylan keeps the rhymes so simple here, it's almost the first thing you think of when you hear the word you. He pairs it with through, new, new again, true, new for a third time, and finally, two. The song is a companion piece to Make You Feel My Love, as in it's a love song. It's not a breakup song or a lovelorn song, it's pure love. The first bridge here recalls the sentiment of the Time Out of Mind tune. So much so, in fact, it's almost acting off the same blueprint. On that song we heard, I'd go hungry, I'd go black and blue, and I'd go crawling down the avenue. No, there's nothing that I wouldn't do to make you feel my love. And here we hear, I'm giving myself to you, I am, from Salt Lake City down to Birmingham. From East LA to San Antonio, I don't think I can bear to live my life alone. Both songs are from a similar narrator, but the more recent cut feels its age. The narrator in Rough and Rowdy Ways is older, and in his later years, he has finally committed himself to his love. Finally, his mind is made up. Time is running out. Whatever held him back before, fear, anxiety, personality, history, situations, whatever it was, it's now meaningless. Love conquers all. It's also confessional in parts. In fact, it's almost glaringly honest and earnest at times. Whilst at the start, our narrator is dreaming of his love lost in the stars, by the end, it appears to have come true. Dylan sings, I've travelled from the mountains to the sea. I hope the gods go easy with me. I knew you'd say yes, I'm saying it too. I've made up my mind to give myself to you.
I've travelled from the mountains to the sea. I hope that the gods go easy with me. I knew you'd say yes. I'm saying it too. I've made up my mind to give myself to you.
While I'm not sure this is autobiographical in terms of Dylan talking about a specific relationship, it has an honesty in terms of there being no pretense to it. It is what it is. This honesty becomes an album theme. Take I Contain Multitudes, for example. It feels like it's the most open Dylan has been with us for years. It also feels like Bob is taking off his mask during track 9, Key West. He sings, I was born on the wrong side of the railroad track, like Ginsberg, Carousel and Kerouac. But most notably, it feels like Dylan the man, not the legend or the star, is sat talking to us directly on track 2, False Prophet. I opened my heart to the world and the world came in, he sings on the second verse, which feels very autobiographical, as does I search the world over for the Holy Grail. I sing songs of love. I sing songs of betrayal. Which could easily be a reference to Dylan's constant touring and his restless work life. Elsewhere he sings, open your mouth, I'll stuff it with gold. Which might be a nod to Dylan's infamous NDAs, which have put a vowel of silence over his private life in a way we have seen with no other celebrity. Whilst this might be stretching it a little bit, they are strange lines. For me, they're fascinating. As an Englishman, something instantly springs to mind. It's a saying that comes from the birth of the NHS, where a former English health secretary is quoted as saying that he would make the National Health Service work by stuffing doctors' mouths with gold, meaning he would allow doctors to work privately as well as working for the NHS, giving them a healthy salary as well as working for their government. In the Dylan context, you feel it's kind of the same. It's a carrot and stick approach, buying someone's silence or cooperation. Later we hear, I ain't no false prophet, it's just what I said. Which for me is the song's most important line. Dylan has been labelled the voice of a generation, a messiah and a prophet for over 40 years. Here he once again is addressing that, and once again he's saying he is no prophet. He's also not a false prophet. He's just a man. He's said what he said and done what he's done, and that's it. Just like we saw with I Contain Multitudes, this is an honest portrayal of Robert Zimmerman. Although having said that, this could be Dylan throwing us off the scent one final time. He knows the whole prophet thing is a talking point for fans and critic alike, so why not smirk at us with a song referencing the whole thing? This could easily be the case, but somehow for me, I feel this record's personal undertones might just lead us to thinking that Bob is being frank for once. Musically, the song, like we've seen endless times before from Dylan, is 12-bar blues, and like we've seen many times before, it's stolen. If Loving Is Believing is a song by Billy the Kid Emerson, and this is not a case of Dylan borrowing the song, he actually copies it. The guitars, chords, tempo, and even some of the fills are exactly the same.
Another day that don't end, another ship going out.
Despite this, like we've seen before, there is no co-writing credit, not a reference, not anything at all to Emerson, who, while not a huge artist, was a Sun Records artist, hardly an unknown. His music is even available on Spotify right now, as is this song. I'm sure Dylan would argue all blues songs come from the same place, and these calls have been repeated so many times, no one really owns them at all. But this is so similar, a nod is surely deserved. Like we've seen a lot in his later day work, this is problematic. As a side note, Dylan has included Emerson's Red Hot and Every Woman I Know on his Theme Time Radio Hour, and a representative for Dylan has been contacted for comment. They've chosen not to comment. Despite its complications, this is a rewarding song. It just has something about it. Sure, it's a blues song, but Dylan's slight alterations make it feel new, modern even. And they give it a swagger too, especially those lines about burying the rest. They could come from Jay-Z. I usually opt for Dylan's slower tempo tunes as favourites. I'd much rather listen to a song like Moonlight than Lonesome Day Blues, for example. But here I'm fully on board with this and its blues partner, track 6, Goodbye Jimmy Reed. The riff here once again is nothing new, but it's so catchy. Dylan's delivery is also charming. He almost winks on that last line as he references a Reed song from 1958, a composition called Down in Virginia from his album, the disappointingly titled Rocking with Reed.
My baby told me her stuff done me wrong. Well, I'm telling you, baby, 'cause I'm tired of living alone.
The song's lyrics are possibly the most ambiguous on the entire album. He covers a few different subjects in the verse and always returns to his hero of Jimmy Reed at the end. Possibly the meaning is Dylan is looking to Reed for help or guidance. It's not a song particularly about Reed or even a homage to him. In fact, he died in the 70s, so I suspect Dylan had dealt with his grief on the matter way before coming to write this song. In the first verse, he mentions religion. In fact, a few religions. It ends with Dylan singing, "Goodbye, Jimmy Reed indeed. Give me that old-time religion. It's just what I need." Old Time Religion is a traditional gospel song dating back to 1873, and though it is a gospel song, it doesn't speak of Jesus or the gospel itself. Dylan appears to be looking for something that hasn't been muddied or corrupted, like an old gospel song, for example, or even Jimmy Reed himself. He continues his search for something pure in the next verse as he sings, "Go tell it on the mountain, go tell the real story." Later, Dylan appears to turn to look at himself. He reminisces about his career and how he's always done it his way. He sings, "You won't amount to much, the people all said, because I didn't play guitar behind my head. Never pandered, never acted proud, never took off my shoes, threw them in the crowd." Here he's almost thanking Reed for being a guiding light, for showing him the way. We continue this theme on the next verse with the lines, "I can't sing a song that I don't understand." In verse 5, we're back to a frustrated Bob looking for answers. It opens with, "Transparent woman in a transparent dress. Suits you well, I must confess." This woman appears to have wronged him, as we follow these lines with, "I need you like my head needs a noose," before we end the verse with, "Goodbye Jimmy Reed, goodbye and so long, I thought I could resist her, but I was so wrong." The act of saying goodbye to Jimmy in each verse, following some gripes, suggests Dylan is seeing Reed as a representation of a better time. Dylan's asking him for that old-time religion. He's confessing his affection for a transparent woman. Dylan mentioned in that New York Times article he thinks about the death of the human race. Is this him yearning for a different time, looking to Reed and something he embodies for Dylan to recreate a past that was purer? In the final verse, we still haven't found any answers. In fact, we're left with a pretty bleak outlook. As Dylan is still searching for answers from Reed, he sings, "I'm just looking for the man. Need to see where he's lying in this lost land." Before finally we get that Virginia closer. This yearning for the past and concern for mankind's downfall is a major theme of the album and is wrapped up in so many different parts of it. From Murder Most Foul's frightful look at America's recent history, to I Contain Multitudes' call for duality in society, to my own version of You's construction of a better human. It's also found in William McKinley being referenced in Key West, another assassinated president, and also another historical leader, this time in the form of Julius Caesar. We found Caesar in my own version of You, but more prominently in the track Crossing the Rubicon. These mighty leaders that have met gruesome deaths complement Dylan's worry for humanity, and none more so than Caesar. In 49 BCE, he was faced with a tough choice. He was sat on the banks of the Rubicon with his 13th Legion. If he crossed it into Rome, that spelled an act of war, a decision from which there is no turning back. In fact, these days, crossing the Rubicon is a phrase used to mean taking a step that cannot be reversed. His crossing of the Rubicon led to the Roman Civil War, which ultimately led to Caesar becoming dictator and the rise of the imperial era of Rome. For me, Dylan uses Caesar's famous crossing and the modern meaning of the phrase to reflect. This is a song of redemption and of hope. I crossed the Rubicon on the 14th day on the most dangerous month of the year. That's our killer opening line. And while Caesar didn't cross the river himself on the 14th, he was murdered on the 15th of March 44 BC. And with the word dangerous thrown in, perhaps Dylan is referencing that. It fits the overall feel of the song. There's a nervous hope to it, a sense things are about to change forever. Like Caesar a day before his death, our narrator is on the cusp of something life-changing. The world around him, as we've seen and heard from Dylan, isn't in a good shape. In this world so badly bent, he sings on the third verse. Preceding this is a line that reads, the worst time and the worst place. And some lyrics that mention blood, too. But our narrator isn't lamenting the end of the world. He's settling scores before he crosses the river, before his life changes and he dies or the world ends. I stood between heaven and earth and crossed the Rubicon, he sings towards the song's climax. We also hear that time is short with the couplets 3 miles north of purgatory, one step from the great beyond, and I cannot redeem the time so idly spent. For the most part, each verse ends with our narrator getting his affairs in order or doing things you would do before death. In fact, it feels throughout the song like we're in purgatory. Things are being sorted out before moving on. We hear, I prayed to the cross, kissed the girls and crossed the Rubicon. I embraced my love, put down my hair and crossed the Rubicon. I pawned my watch, I paid my debts, and crossed the Rubicon. This final line fits the speculation about the song's opener. The Ides of March, or the 15th of March, when Julius Caesar was murdered, is also a deadline for Romans to settle their debts. We seem to be hearing from a narrator looking for peace or resolution before the end. This is something we've seen many times from Dylan before, on both Modern Times and Time Out of Mind, to name just two albums. Thankfully, it appears to have a happy ending, unlike a lot of other songs. In the first verse, we hear our narrator mention being up at dawn, and in the final words, we're back there. Dylan mentions looking to the east, where the sun rises from. Whether it's the same dawn, or perhaps this is a day later, and our narrator, in the guise of Caesar, has settled his debts and is now ready to meet his maker, just like Julius did on the 15th, we don't quite know. Either way, it's a defiant ending. It sounds like our narrator is off on an adventure, crossing over from one world to another. He's ready for the next step, and he's taking it. Bob sings, I lit the torch, I looked to the east, and crossed the Rubicon.
I lit the torch, I looked to the east, and I crossed the Rubicon.
We're back in purgatory for the album's penultimate song, Key West. And it's a masterpiece.
Key West is the place to be if you're looking for immortality. Stay on the road, follow the highway sign.
Once again, just like on I've Made Up My Mind, we have quite a middle-of-the-road sounding guitar riff. Dylan continues his love affair with the accordion, which we can now call a second half of his career staple at this point. He also does what he's been doing throughout the album, and that is complimenting his voice. I'm not sure it would be a conscious decision really, especially not from anyone but Dylan, but these songs really tend to suit his voice. He's always had that sand and glue sound, as Bowie described it, and in recent years it's been a little more sandpaper than sand. Whilst it's never become a bad voice, it has been weathered at times. On the preceding album, Tempest, it sounded used after years of touring. And I say that not as a criticism, but you feel the songs were occasionally out of step with Dylan's vocals. He would be writing and singing songs that maybe would have suited his voice 10 years previous. There was definitely some reaching at points. Here, though, the songs suit his voice. In fact, as a live act, Dylan's voice is also sounding its strongest it's sounded for years, something that has also helped make the vocals for these songs so good. He retains the character of recent albums, but adds a smoothness to it. It's like a fine coffee. It's not sugary sweet, but it's undeniably characterful. This is coupled with his diction, which at times is that of a great storyteller. He half speaks, half sings his way through the songs, almost acting at points. The rest of the sonics of the song are very rough and rowdy ways sounding. There's those almost ethereal backing vocals and a very spacious soundscape. In fact, the song almost feels quite motionless at times. It sort of hangs in the air, like the descriptions we hear of Key West itself. It's tranquil and almost dreamlike. It's the sound of a warm summer's day condensed. Which isn't a million miles away from Key West itself. Key West is an island in the Straits of Florida, as I'm sure you know. The lyrics concentrate on themes well known to Dylan. The death of a president is how we begin the song. Once again, Dylan is using these deaths of large characters to illustrate his points. The opening lines are, McKinley hollered, McKinley squalled, doctor said, McKinley, death is on the wall. If, like me, and your US history is shaky at best, then William McKinley was the 25th President of the United States, who was assassinated in 1901. The lines are taken from a folk standard called White House Blues, which is also about the death of the president. Those lines are, McKinley hollered, McKinley squalled, Doc said McKinley, I can't find the ball. The ball, we assume, is the bullet that killed him. He was shot in Buffalo in New York on the 6th of September 1901, 6 months into his second term. Our narrator hears about this via his radio, which, intentionally or not, gives a shout-out to the legendary radio station Radio Luxembourg, a joy to hear for radio geeks like me. Back on the subject, and our narrator listening to the radio hears of McKinley's passing, and that's pretty much what makes up the whole of the first verse. We then head to the chorus with lines like, Key West is the place to be if you're looking for immortality. Stay on the road, follow the highway sign. Key West is fine and fair. If you lose your mind, you'll find it there. Key West is on the horizon line. Which feels like our narrator is almost beckoning McKinley to join him in this place of immortality, or even goading him from what appears to be a safe haven, a dreamy purgatory, if you will. But a purgatory in the sense of it being a place of purification, as opposed to its other meaning of suffering. Key West is the place to go, down by the Gulf of Mexico, beyond the sea, beyond the shifting sands. Key West is the gateway key to innocence and purity. Key West is the enchanted land. That's what Dylan sings on the second verse. And later we hear, feel the sunlight on your skin and the healing virtues of the wind. There's definitely a sense that Key West is some sort of mythical retreat from the world. Even more so when we hear a small section about Truman having his White House on the famous Florida island, which is in fact true. In fact, a number of presidents have briefly moved the White House down there for a break. For Truman, it was in 1946. Having just finished 19 months in office, he was physically exhausted. His doctor, Wallace Graham, ordered a warm vacation. Truman arrived in November and didn't stop coming back. In fact, he spent 175 days on 11 visits there during his presidency. Given those lines before and this presidential retreat feeling, we can call Key West a place of purification. Elsewhere, because this is a Dylan song, there's a ton of musical references added in. He mentions the folk standard My Pretty Little Miss, for example, and also tells us to try a little tenderness. And while Key West is labelled as a mythical place throughout the song's 9.5 minute runtime, it's also very real too. As well as the facts about the Truman White House and the area's vegetation, he also mentions Amelia Street and Bayview Park, both real life places. So while the Key West in this song is a similar place to that of Highlands in the song of the same name from Time Out of Mind, this feels a little less of a fantasy. Both songs are similar. They're both conclusions of a sort. Lengthy songs at the ends of albums detailing another sort of world. Perhaps the next one on from this. But while Highlands is very dreamlike with some off-the-wall passages like the song's Waitress Exchange, this song is different. At the end of the Time Out of Mind cut, we hear Dylan sing, "There's a way to get there and I'll figure it out somehow. Well, I'm already there in my mind and that's good enough for now." On Key West, though, it looks like he's finally got there. He's speaking from experience as Dylan sings, Key West is paradise divine, Key West is fine and fair.
Key West is paradise divine.
Key West is fine and fair. If you lost your mind, you'll find it there. Key West is on the horizon line.
But who exactly is our narrator, the possible philosopher pirate from the title? It seems to be a person looking for escape from the world, which at this stage is no real surprise. But could it be Dylan? Well, possibly. We hear a passage of "I was born on the wrong side of the railroad track," like Ginsberg, Corso and Kerouac, like Jimmy and Buddy and all the rest. Which could easily be a description of Bob. And so could the lines, 12 years old, they put me in a suit, forced me to marry a prostitute. There were gold fringes on her wedding dress. That's my story, but not where it ends. She's still cute and we're still friends. While we can probably safely say Bob didn't marry a prostitute at age 12, it could easily be a metaphor for his bar mitzvah, which took place 2 days before his 13th birthday. Religion is the prostitute here. The gold fringes could be referring to the tallit, a fringed garment traditionally worn either under or over one's clothing by Jewish males. While the lines about the story not ending there and still being friends fits our expectations of Dylan's current religious beliefs. This theory at times does feel like a little bit of a stretch, but I wouldn't rule it out because, as we've seen, at times on Rough and Rowdy Ways, things get much more personal than we're used to with Bob. Either way, our pirate narrator seems quite happy in this other world setting. Like their name suggests, he's been trying to get away from the world, living by his own rules, a pirate hauled up in Key West, finally at peace. This is a world away from another of the album's best tracks, Black Rider. This is an angsty, bitter, troubled song. The sonics are excellent. For me, along with my own version of You and Murder Most Foul, they do their best to spice up the album's production. Just like the former of those two songs, the music sounds like it was recorded in a morgue. It's macabre, it's gallows music. It sounds like the sort of thing you'd hear played just before a hanging in medieval Britain. It's atmospheric and it's lush.
Black rider, black rider, all dressed in black.
What sounds like a mandolin pans slightly into the right ear puts the whole thing on a knife edge. It makes the atmosphere with its high-tuned, muted strum. This is complemented by Dylan's delivery, where he sounds close to the mic and unfiltered. It's like he's taken his makeup off. It unabashedly takes your focus. The percussion, when we have it, is so sparse that the drum beat is almost chilling. Its reverberating clang brings us back to that gallows feeling, as does the almost flamenco-sounding guitars, which build tension throughout the song. As to who the Black Rider is, well, death is obviously our first thought. The use of the word rider, though, indicates it's something that is always with our narrator, riding along or along for the ride, almost mocking our narrator. It could also be a reference to Stephen Crane's book, Black Riders and Other Lines, which is a collection of poems. Crane was an American novelist and poet. Dylan mentions him in his autobiography Chronicles, so we can assume he is a fan. The Black Riders from Crane's book deals with the affirmation of the existence of sin and ends with the affirmation of the existence of God. The idea of sin fits into the Dylan song too. We appear to be dealing with a narrator grappling with something. Perhaps the Black Rider is the other side of their personality, a sinful side, or even a sinful past. There's definitely a war going on. I don't want to fight, at least not today, Dylan sings at one point. We also hear a personal struggle with, I'll suffer in silence, I'll not make a sound. Dylan singing as our narrator is keeping the whole thing internalised. Later we hear, my soul is distressed, my mind is at war, don't hug me, don't flatter me, don't turn on the charm. The my mind is at war line there is the standout for me. Elsewhere in that verse, our narrator is trying to shake his internal rider with threats. I'll hack off your arm, he sings. There's also another hint to a sinful past in verse 3 on the lines, black rider, all dressed in black. I'm walking away, you try to make me look back. My heart is at rest, I'd like to keep it that way. With that line about their heart being at rest, it would appear our narrator is actually pretty happy, but the black rider keeps dragging them back. You feel he's trying not to get lost in his life of previous sin. This is also perhaps addressed in a line that is somewhat out of the blue for Dylan, as he sings, the size of your cock will get you nowhere. Which is pretty bold. It's also kind of a killer line when you ignore the eyebrow raising. It obviously alludes to a sinful life full of ego and infidelity, which is ultimately unfulfilling. It could also be a reference to a Roman satirist called Juvenal, who apparently said, "If your stars go against you, the fantastic size of your cock will get you precisely nowhere." Which obviously alludes to the fact that no matter how important or successful or good in bed you are, ultimately, if the stars are against you, they're against you. While this again does feel like a little bit of a stretch at times, it's not completely out of the question. It wouldn't be the first time an ancient Greek or ancient Roman quote has popped up in a Dylan tune. Regardless, we finish with our narrator once again calling for the Black Rider to leave. He sings, "Some enchanted evening I'll sing you a song. Black Rider, you've been on the job too long." Whether our narrator is rid of his demon by the end, we never know. That very final line, though, could be a nod to a folk murder ballad called Duncan and Brady. In the song, Duncan shoots Brady, and we hear a repeated line of, "He'd been on the job too long." Dylan had covered this song live many times, and he also cut it for a studio album too that never materialised. Perhaps in this final line, our narrator is finally killing off his Black Rider. This whole song, for me, is one of the album's high points. Its lowest is track 7, Mother of Muses.
Mother of Muses, sing for me. Sing of the mountains and the deep dark sea.
This song sounds like a cut from Christmas in the Heart and representative of the album's safe production. Whilst, as I've stated, we do go off-piste with thrilling results, the majority of this album sounds as you'd expect it to for the most part. I know others will disagree, but take latter-day Johnny Cash or even David Bowie albums, and you feel Dylan is definitely playing it safe sonically compared to them. It's a small criticism in the album's full picture, and at the same time, this song does represent just how good this album is. Its worst song is a good song. A friend of mine who works in the music business at a pretty high level once said to me, with top-level bands and artists, it's all about managing the decline. The best artists and bands make great records and great songs and also have a quality with everything else they do. Not every song is going to be as good as Murder Most Foul. Creativity just doesn't work like that. Here, Dylan makes a great album, and inevitably when we get to a song that isn't as powerful as his best, he does a good job in making sure it doesn't hinder the rest. The song's best attribute is its lyrics. I love some of the lines here, including, "Mother of Muses, wherever you are, I've already outlived my life, by far." And its final verse concluding with, "Got a mind that ramble, got a mind that roam, I'm travelling light and I'm a slow coming home."
Got a mind to ramble, got a mind to roam, I'm travelling light and I'm a slow coming home.
Rough and Rowdy Ways is an incredible record. It's complex, it's layered, and it's a personal album that both continues themes Dylan has explored before and expands on them. While at times it would be nice to have a completely surprising record from Bob, its sonics thrill enough to entertain. It also sounds very modern from start to finish. In fact, Dylan at 79 doesn't sound his age in performance, production or verse. Crucially, it's never forced either. We as fans were made to wait, and the wait was well worth it. Like we saw in 1997, after a break punctuated with some covers albums, Dylan has delivered a classic. We should be mindful that these latest two eras in Dylan's career are real treats for us fans. We had it good from Time Out of Mind's resurgence through to Tempest, and we can only hope that Rough and Rowdy Ways is the start of another era that puts beyond any doubt that Bob Dylan's back catalogue is a body of work like no other.
I knew you'd say yes. I'm saying it too. I've made up my mind to give myself to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode and for joining us on a brand new season of Bob Dylan album by album. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I hope you've been enjoying the Rough and Rowdy Ways record as well. I mean, what a treat it was for Dylan to come back when he did. And it's always great to hear a new Bob Dylan album, regardless of kind of how good it is or how bad it is. But the fact he came up with a classic is, it's almost a relief, isn't it? but a brilliant, brilliant record to return with. And I hope that came across in the episode. As usual, share your thoughts on it, please. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Bob Dylan Podcast. You can drop me an email via bobdylanpodcast.com. And also don't forget you can tip the show as well. The Buy Me a Coffee link, as I mentioned at the start of the show, is in the description for this podcast. Thank you once again for listening. Next time we're having a look at an album that I guess is a bit of an anomaly in Dylan's back catalogue. It saw him reunited with the band, it saw him on a brand new record label, and it was the precursor to one of his best ever albums. We're looking at Planet Waves, so join us next time for that.
A Fueled by Coffee production.